Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Well, Don't Just Stand There. I'm Johan, your host as usual. Got a lot of stuff coming in this episode, but it's going to be a relatively quick one, so I'm going to try to get through this in fast bursts of information, so just bear with me. But we'll kick off with some of the more exciting stuff. SpaceX launched a rocket into low Earth orbit, delivered 11 satellites, and then landed stage one of the rocket vertically back on Earth on a landing site right next to the launch site. Super cool. Star Wars, obviously, demolishing box office records. I want to talk very briefly about how I felt about it. Drone registration. The FAA is instituting new rules that says hobbyists and commercial drone operators need to register. Netflix is busting out a new compression algorithm. A VR headset that isn't actually VR. Data leaks from a dating website that really should have its shit together. CISA will become law. Snuck into a massive budget appropriations bill, which is not good news. Obama is going to sign it, which is unfortunate. And a metal that is 99% air. It's called microlattice, and it has lots of really interesting commercial applications. Gonna dig into all of that next, and maybe a little bit more. Coming up.
The Force was strong with this movie.
So, all right. Huge Star Wars nerd. Obviously, I had to go see it the moment that it came out. Not going to talk too much about it. That's not really what this podcast is normally about. Just want to say, fantastic film. Enjoyed it. It's an 8.25 out of 10 for me. There's a lot of little nitpicks, but I think everybody should absolutely go see it. Not that everybody who wasn't going to hasn't already planned to in the next couple of weekends. This thing demolished the weekend box office record set by Jurassic World and by, I think, just about $40 million in a single weekend, which is extraordinary, and broke records for single day theater tallies, and it's, you know, easily going to burst past $1 billion. Clearly this thing is a huge commercial success, which means Disney's plan to turn this into a turnkey one movie a year franchise for the foreseeable future is probably going to kick off in a big way. So next year there's going to be a non-episode movie, Star Wars Rogue One, and then we're going to have, obviously, Episode 8, and then there's going to be another movie that is outside of the episode sort of timeline, and they're just going to kick that thing off and keep running until this whole sponge has been wrung entirely dry. But based on what I saw in this movie, pretty excited about that prospect. They've really respected a lot of what made the original episodes great. So, looking forward to see more of that. I'm going to segue right into more space. SpaceX has been working on for a long time VTOL capability, vertical takeoff and landing, for its rockets. This is super important for a lot of reasons, and they've had a huge milestone this week when their Falcon 9 rocket, on a commercial mission that somebody paid them to deliver satellites, flew up into low Earth orbit, delivered 11 satellites, and then the first stage of that rocket that has the biggest engines, basically the largest component of the rocket before it sort of breaks up into pieces in low Earth orbit, landed back by the launch site on a flat surface, standing upright, using just the rocket boosters to orient it and land it. So now they can reuse this part of the rocket. This is hugely important for a couple financial reasons. Going to space is incredibly expensive. A Falcon 9 rocket costs something like $16 million. And out of that cost, the fuel is only $200,000. It's a lot of money, but it's a tiny percentage of the cost of going to space. Imagine if in domestic air travel, they threw away the airplane after every single flight. It would be outrageously expensive. You would never be able to fly. Almost no one would be able to fly. And that same concept applies to rocketry. The fact that they can salvage a piece of this rocket, refurbish it, and launch it again will cut millions of dollars off of the bottom line of every single rocket launch. Which means where it now costs somewhere around $10,000 a pound to get something into space, Elon Musk, CEO of SpaceX, says they're targeting getting it down to maybe $500 a pound, which is huge. That opens up commercial space to a lot of things. It opens it up to tourism. It opens it up to smaller companies getting up satellites that couldn't normally do it before. It's just a huge thing. They're in the very early stages of trying to make sure that this actually works out. But the fact that they've had the successful test, that it landed intact, they've made several attempts, and they've gotten it very close, but there's been a lot of rockets landing and then falling over and exploding lately. So this is a big deal, and it's probably going to open up a new chapter in spaceflight. And at some point, you're going to be reading a history book, and they're going to say, this is when it started. This is when low cost, relatively speaking, space travel became possible. So do yourself a favor, check out, look for the SpaceX landing video on YouTube. I'm sure you can find it pretty easily. Super cool watching what looks like basically a launch of a rocket played in reverse as this thing lands on the launch pad. Super exciting stuff. Drone papers, please. The FAA is instituting new guidelines that cover the usage of commercial and hobbyist drones. And that starts off with a big drone registration program. You need to go in and register any drone over a certain size with the FAA so that they can track you and know who's flying what and where, especially if you're doing something for commercial purposes like, say, Amazon delivering packages to your front door. The fine for not registering your drone and them finding out about it is $27,500 and potentially several years in prison. So they're pretty serious about it. And they've spent a lot of time trying to work on these regulations and get people into the mindset that the FAA is going to be pretty strict on what's happening. A lot of these drones that are coming out now for hobbyists or, you know, professional hobbyists, as it were, have the ability to fly into legal airspace. These are pretty powerful toys at this point, and a lot of them could barely be classified as toys. A lot of different concerns, though, about how they're approaching the registration because, number one, they're outsourcing this to a third party, which is not entirely unusual, but one of the details about how they're implementing this process is that anyone will be able to look up any person who's registered, not just the commercial drone operators, but the hobbyists, and find out things like their name and their address. Now, if you're buying a very expensive toy, probably the last thing you want is for anyone to be able to publicly look you up, find out your address, and, you know, I don't know, find you, rob you. There's a lot of legitimate concerns about having this kind of information publicly available. Now, I'm not against the idea of having a registration. You register cars. Nobody has a problem with that. But when you have information that you are forcing people to divulge, and then you are making that publicly accessible with very little control, that I have a problem with. There are enough issues with people being able to control the data that they have about themselves out in the world. We don't need another source of people's information that could be compromised. And the FAA certainly doesn't need to make it public in that sense. So several different drone enthusiast organizations are suing for them to change this. A lot of hobbyists and activists in the space are looking into ways to get them to change the way that they're implementing this database. So hopefully they come to their senses and make this just a little less exposing for people who like to operate drones for fun. Netflix is busting out a new compression algorithm. So they deliver something like a third of all of the data during prime time, internet time in the United States. And that's a lot of data. And getting a good compression algorithm can reduce the amount of data that they send by a huge amount if they do it right. And currently what they're doing is a one-size-fits-all. Everything gets compressed into a file in the same way. So My Little Pony and The Avengers get compressed in the same way. Obviously, there's a lot more visual information and data and action and movement and nuance in The Avengers. The action and detail of an animated feature is usually a lot less. You have a lot of repetitive use of colors and backgrounds. These are things that could definitely benefit from being compressed in a different way. And you could deliver an HD cartoon for probably a tenth of the bandwidth that you could deliver an HD modern action blockbuster. So Netflix knows this, and they're working on new ways to change this, which would actually help out a lot of people who are watching this content. You certainly wouldn't need to be burning through as much of your internet bandwidth while watching a cartoon as when you're watching a blockbuster movie, so maybe you shouldn't have to pay for it, and a lot of people do. A lot of people pay by the gigabyte, and so this is something that will help out both sides. So it's very interesting to see what will come of this. They're working on ways to get the nuance of their compression even more sort of minute so that individual scenes in the same movie could be compressed in a different way. When you have two people standing in a room having a serious conversation, you don't need the same amount of data compression as you do for a huge action scene that happens several minutes later. Kind of cool to see them kind of working on the margins of this, especially since Netflix is kind of the unofficial largest content delivery platform in the world right now. So we'll see what happens there, but cool stuff they're working on in their labs and, you know, going to make it easier to watch a lot of cartoons, which I'm not against in any way. Don't call it VR. A company called Avigant has unveiled a headset that looks an awful lot like a VR headset called Glyph. But basically, the whole point of this thing is bring your computer and TV monitors closer to your face in super high definition and make it feel like you're watching an 80-inch screen in front of you. Give you a close-up and personal movie experience. They're trying very hard to avoid any comparisons to VR headsets for understandable reasons. It's not offering a lot of the same benefits, but it's definitely another way to look a little bit strange in the comfort of your own home coming soon. This is super interesting because there's now several different versions of this technology floating around. We have minimized screens that are basically just that. In this headset, you have the augmented reality of Microsoft's HoloLens, where you can see through it and images are projected onto what you are seeing with your own eyes in the space around you. And then you have things like the HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift virtual reality headsets, where you are truly immersed in a virtual world. But you kind of look the same wearing all these headsets. But this is sort of the third, maybe most normal entry into the field of strange visual headsets. Be keeping an eye on that, but I imagine it won't be making nearly as much of a splash as VR and AR. Data Leaks, a dating app for HIV-positive daters, has had a breach. This is all kinds of unfortunate. This is kind of the exact company that you would hope has incredible protections in place for this kind of sensitive information. The app is called H-Zone, and it's a dating app, and more than 5,000 of their members may have had their personal information compromised. It's just another cautionary tale of you don't know how secure these companies are. You give a lot of people your personal data every single day, and it's really hard. It's really difficult for anybody, even the technically savvy, to know just how secure your data is once you've delivered it to them. And when you have assumptions about things being safe because, you know, they kind of have to be, you know, like Ashley Madison, you know, you would expect them to have had incredible security just because of the nature of the site, which is, hey, discretion is required here. And then you have a dating app like this, where this kind of information is incredibly private, and it's incredibly important to people to be able to keep this to themselves and be able to compartmentalize this information. But it just turns out that that isn't the case. Seems that a lot of the places that really should have the best security are not the most secure, and in fact are often less secure. And that's terrifying because we have these assumptions and we project them on the world around us, especially when it comes to apps and things that are sort of self-enclosed, and we have no way to look at what goes on inside or behind the scenes for these different services. They're just out there, and they claim to offer this service, and often they do offer that service exactly as advertised, but we make these assumptions about the nature in which these companies work, how the apps work, how the technology works, and we're disappointed time and time again. And it's just another cautionary tale. It's very unfortunate. I don't know what else to say about it, but it just seems to me that, you know, some things are maybe just best kept to yourself or done in a more manual way than to instantly trust a new service out on the scene, whatever it may be that you're hoping to keep to yourself. I've talked about it before on the podcast, CISA, the Cyber Information Security Act, will become law. It got snuck into the massive budget appropriations bill, the one that's been haggled over by Democrats and Republicans for a while, and there's simply no chance that it's going to come out. Obama was already tentatively in favor of a lot of the provisions in this bill. As a reminder to those of you who don't remember me talking about it, the main gist of it is this provides a lot of legal protections for digital companies like Facebook and Google for delivering your information to intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies. It's basically a big old butt covering bill for a lot of these services and provides a legal framework and a pathway for your personal information kept on these social sites, on these search sites, wherever it may be, anything digital, and allows that to be delivered to law enforcement. And an original writing of this bill had this only for cyber crimes. That was the original gist of why they needed this bill. We'd had these big breaches, we'd had government breaches, there was this pressure on the Obama administration and on government in general to step up and provide a better avenue and better resources for our crime-fighting agencies to tackle cybercrime. So the idea was, hey, let's have these digital companies provide information on people committing cybercrimes, and this will give them cover to allow them to cooperate with us. And that on its own is not entirely nefarious, but like people suspected when this initially came out, hey, they're going to broaden this out. It's going to start with cybercrimes, and then it's going to become everything. And now it is. Any kind of crime, really, is covered. So any kind of information that you may be posting that could be related to any kind of infraction can now be seamlessly delivered with all the legal cover in the world by Facebook, if you're talking about drugs, or Google, if you're researching things that are maybe kind of sketchy or skirting the edge of the law. They can send that directly to whichever intelligence agency. So the framework is there, and Obama is going to sign it. Now, just like everything else, these laws can be amended, they can be changed, and if I see resources and ways in which you can pitch in, if you want to sign any kind of petition, or if something comes along, just know that I'll share it on this podcast, because this is something I'm passionate about, and this is not a win in our book by any measure. It is a loss, but all of these things can be reversed with lots of activism, lots of phone calls, and lots of heckling of elected representatives. So I'm not giving up on it. This is going to become a law, and you should know about that. But we're going to roll it back. You'll see. Just a last note on something that is pretty neat. It's called microlattice. It's a small lattice-like formation of metal that is, by volume, 99% air because of all of the pockets inside of it. And this is really cool because it allows a really small usage of materials in a super strong shape. The lattice has really strong geometric shapes that basically reinforce all of the strength of the metal to allow you to have something that's super light and super strong and can be used in structural applications. There's a lot of places where this could be used, like in the body of a car or an airplane, and reduce the weight massively. This is made by a laboratory called HRL Labs, and they are pretty much getting this thing ready for commercial application. So we could see this sometime very soon in planes, trains, and automobiles, which is super neat. Allows us to build things that are stronger, and since they're lighter, they're going to be more fuel efficient. You're going to need a smaller engine. Everything can improve. The whole performance profile of anything can improve if you lower the weight but maintain all of the same properties, including strength and flexibility and whatever else is you're relying on this material for. So, super cool. I'm looking forward to seeing whether or not this means cars are going to be hundreds of pounds lighter and planes are going to be thousands of pounds lighter, because that means better performance, lower prices, less impact on the environment. And it's these kind of small improvements that at the front of it just seems like, hey, this is a neat invention, but it has huge knock-on effects, especially if it can be applied commercially. Thanks for listening in. I know I said this would be a quick one. It turned out to be kind of exactly the same length as most of the other podcasts that I've done, but I got through a lot, and I think I only monologued just a little bit on all of these different things. Thanks for tuning in. Merry Christmas to everybody, and happy holidays. There'll be some intermittent outages in my podcast posting, as I will be hanging out with family and friends, but I'll try to maintain a somewhat regular schedule, and no doubt the news will not stop coming in the meantime. But thanks so much for listening. Once again, this has been episode 10 of Well, Don't Just Stand There. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Johan Benedict, or on the web at johancodes.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you guys next week. Music provided under Creative Commons license by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.